In a world where jobs are how most people make money, one man, one desire, one challenge dares to break the mold. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where we don't work for money. Money works for us. Coming soon, viewer discretion advised.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where cash flow is king. Real estate investing, the means, so you can enjoy your retirement dreams. This is the show where we cut right to the chase. No sales pitch, no long monologues, just simple how-to real estate investing advice, so you can earn the passive income you need to enjoy your retirement today. And now, your host and chief old dog, Bill Manassero.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network. I'm your host, Bill Manassero, and this is the show where 50-plussers and anyone else who wants to join us get solid, no-sales-pitch real estate investing advice to help generate real cash flow. This podcast airs twice weekly on Mondays and Fridays, and if you aren't already a subscriber, go to iTunes or Apple Podcasts, type in Old Dogs, spelled D-A-W-G-S, find our podcast and subscribe. Well, we have a fun show for you today. We have a returning guest. This is actually his third appearance here on the Old Dogs REI Network and a fellow old dog. He was on first time December 5th, 2016. And I'm going to definitely harass him about this, but why apartments are the perfect investment.
Okay.
And then we went to, 2017 when you talked about finding a mentor. Great show, and a show that I've referenced a lot of times in the past about some creative ways to find mentors. So I'm talking about Paul Moore, if you guys haven't figured it out yet. I'll give you his background here. After a stint at Ford Motor Company, Paul co-founded a staffing firm where he was two-time finalist for Michigan Entrepreneur of the Year. After selling to a publicly traded firm, Paul began investing in real estate, which is what a lot of people do when they sell their businesses and get this big chunk of cash. He founded multiple investment and development companies, appeared on HGTV, and completed over 100 commercial and residential investments and exits. He has contributed to Fox Business, The Real Estate Guys Show, and is a regular contributor to Bigger Pockets, producing live video and blog content there. Paul also co-hosted a wealth building podcast called How to Lose Money. Of course, I was on this show, and that's really a subject for another podcast. But anyway, he has been featured as a guest on over 200 podcasts, so you guys must have heard him somewhere. He is a three-time real estate author, and Bigger Pockets recently published his new book called Storing Up Profits: Capitalize on America's Obsession with Stuff by Investing in Self-Storage. Paul is the founder and managing partner of Wellings Capital, a real estate private equity firm. Wellings Capital designates a portion of its profits to thwart human trafficking and rescue its victims. Well, Paul, you old dog, welcome back to the Old Dogs REI Network.
It's been too long. It's great to be here, Bill. I'm honored.
Way too long. Except, you know, being an old dog, I really can't remember how long. But hey, it's good to have you back.
Yeah, it's great to be here. How have you been?
I've been doing good, man. Doing good. Just living the life and getting ready to move out of California to head east.
Yeah, well, we'll be neighbors, I guess.
Yeah.
Down the road in Virginia.
I think so. That's awesome. Well, we're going to have to find a good midway point there and grab a cup of Java.
Yeah, it'd be tremendous.
Well, what have you been up to since we last spoke? I know the listeners would love to hear. You know, it's just been a while, so it's been quite a few years.
Yeah.
So
yeah, about 4 years.
Yeah, huh? Yeah.
Well, I wrote a book called The Perfect Investment, and that book was about multifamily. And, you know, I love multifamily. I really do. The demographics, are phenomenal looking decades out. The default rate is low. They're recession resistant. There's lots of reasons to love multifamily. In fact, I was meeting with Doug Duncan. I actually met him in an airport. I shouldn't say we were meeting. I was sitting next to him in an airport. He's the chief economist for Fannie Mae, and he explained why he's been saying there's a growing supply and demand gap. It's been going on for a long, long time in multifamily. And at best, it'll take almost a decade just to catch up. Some of the things he loves and we love about it is baby boomers are going in, you know, increasingly into apartments, and they never go back when they do. The Gen X, the millennials, Gen Z, all going more and more toward apartments, and so are immigrants. They rent more often and for longer than folks born in America. But there's a problem. The perfect investment's not perfect if you can't find deals that make financial sense. The space is significantly overheated. The cap rates are at a record low, which means prices are at a record high, of course. There's 1031 money willing to overpay, IRA investors sometimes willing to overpay, institutional and international money coming in at a record torrent pace. The Tax Reform Act of 2017 added fuel to the overheated fire. There's the NUREW impact. You know what that is, right, Bill?
No, I don't.
No, the NUREW impact. I made up that word, and nobody knows it, apparently. I'm trying to coin a new word. It's new people, in people who are new in the business, and now they are coining them, so they're calling themselves gurus. And so they're new gurus, NUREWs, and they're leading people. They're saying things like, it's different this time. And it's not true. It's not different this time. We've got hundreds of years to prove it's not. There's always ups and downs in a market. Trees don't grow to the sky. And I'm not willing at this point in the cycle, in general, to invest our money and our investors' money, more importantly, in multifamily deals that are often significantly overpriced. I've got a lot of data points on this. I still love multifamily. Just invested $250,000 in a multifamily deal, sort of as a test investment with an operator. But honestly, we've really slowed down for the last 4 years. And when I finally stopped banging my head against the wall for multifamily, probably about a year after we last were on the show here, Bill, we actually decided we wanted to find an asset class that had more meat on the bone, more potential upside, a lot more mom and pop operators. And we found that in self-storage.
Well, I hear, yes, that's all I hear lately is self-storage, that and industrial. I'm in two hot, hot areas right now for commercial. I wanted to hear from you, especially since you've got a new book on it. You seem like you've been in it for a little while, and you're still really excited about it. So I want to hear why.
Yeah, well, what happened is probably early 2018, somebody called me. I have an investor call scheduling, on my calendar, and an investor called. I thought it was an investor, and I thought he wanted to talk about multifamily, but Chris actually said, I just want to tell you why I switched to self-storage. Would you like to hear? No, I thought. Yes, I said, because I'm a nice guy. He actually gave me this incredible half an hour pitch on why self-storage was so powerful. I had to admit, I was pretty intrigued. And so we did another 2.5 hour call, and I was sold enough to come to the headquarters of his new company where he was raising money for self-storage. And then I went to find a book on self-storage, and I was really disappointed. There were a handful of self-published books, one pretty good one about marketing specifically, but honestly, I didn't see a lot. So I immediately, once we were about a year into the business, I said, you know what? I think I'm going to write a book on self-storage. And so Bigger Pockets agreed to publish it in 2019. COVID held it up a year. So we're finally rolling it out here in November of 2021.
Awesome. Well, I've looked at self-storage. In fact, that is really one of the areas that I seriously may move into as I shift everything over to more passive investing. Mm-hmm. you know, there are some areas that look like, you know, they're kind of oversaturated. And then, So I was kind of going, well, you know, how do I know, you know, I've got to do like a little market study if I'm going to invest in one of these facilities.
Right.
How do you know where to go? And are there, you know, some areas that are definitely hotter than others? And how does that part of it, and as you're searching for good investments?
Yeah, well, if it's okay with you, Bill, I'll just go over some of the things we like about, actually love about self-storage, and then that'll lead us to the answer to your question. Would that be okay?
That's great. Let's do it.
Well, first of all, 93% of the multifamily assets over 50 units are owned by multi-asset owners, corporations who have typically bled the value-add opportunities out of multifamily. But self-storage has 75% independent owners, and 2 out of 3 of those independent owners are mom and pops. In other words, they own one facility, like the guy I talked to half an hour ago, who has one facility. He said, my wife got pregnant. I think we're going to sell it. Well, I like that, you know, because there might be upside there. I said, when did you last raise the rents? He said, oh, we've owned it for 6 years. We've never raised rents. And he's already the lowest price in the market, and he's full, and he doesn't advertise, and he likes it that way. You see, there's a lot of mom and pop owners in self-storage. The size of the industry is similar to the total of Subway, McDonald's, and Starbucks combined, about 53,000 facilities. But like I said, about half are mom and pop. And the power of this, Bill, is incredible, because there are lots of value add opportunities. Now, when I first heard value adds, I laughed. I thought, wait, we're talking 4 pieces of sheet metal, some rivets, a floor, and a door. How are you going to do value add? Where are the countertops and paint and lighting and doors and cabinet opportunities? But there are a lot of value adds. And if you remind me later, I'll go through some of those. One thing we love is the rents are price inelastic. And here's what I mean. I mean, if I have a $1,000 apartment and my landlord raises it 6%, I might leave rather than pay an extra, you know, $720 a year, $60 a month. But if I have a $100 self-storage unit on a month-to-month lease and the operator raises it 6%, I'm probably not going to spend a weekend, fill up a U-Haul, get my friends together to move my treasures, junk, whatever, down the street to save $6 a month. Because people typically think they're not going to be there that long anyway. So the prices are inelastic. Self-storage has done fantastic during booms when people are filling up their Walmart and Amazon carts, but also really well in bad times like recessions, the pandemic. The news since the pandemic is self-storage has, you know, come out as the clear winner with restaurants shutting down and businesses moving, you know, from their offices to homes. There's a lot of filled up self-storage facilities and the prices have gone wild. The great thing about these mom and pop owners, Bill, is that it really is easy to manage a self-storage facility if you're willing to be mediocre. But if you want to be great, you can buy one of those mediocre facilities, pay them top dollar for what they have, and you can convert it into a really powerful profit machine. And if you can portfolio a bunch of those together in a group under a similar operating flag, marketing flag, website, et cetera, you can potentially sell them to an institutional buyer. So there's lots of great things about self-storage. One thing to worry about is competition. We invested in one near Tampa, Florida, and 2 big national competitors popped up next door. I mean, you know, within the same mile at least. And that really, really hurt the lease up of this fairly new facility. So, yeah, as far as what to look for, you're going to want to be on a main road. You're going to want to have high visibility on that main road, not behind a hill or, you know, behind a Walmart or something. You're going to want to do a market study to see how many competitors there are, to see how many square feet of self-storage are already in about a 3-mile radius typically. And you're going to want to have middle to high income. You're not going to want to be in a, you know, low income area in general. And that's what you want to look for. And of course, you know, and I know as passive investors, it's more important to get the right operator than just the right facility. A great operator can fix a mediocre facility. A bad operator can ruin any great facility.
So that seems like that would be a definitely a key player. Well, just like property management, you know, you have multifamily, you have a bad property manager, forget it. You know, you've got a bad investment until you replace that person. So what role does the operator have? Is that an outside company? Is that a local person you hire? I mean, who is the operator?
The operator is the asset manager, the syndicator, you know, the folks who operate the facility. And they either hire a third party to do property management, like Life Storage or Easy Storage, one of those to do the property management, or they do it in-house. So I should say the syndicator.
The person that has the deal for the most part.
Right.
So the people that are operating, that are sort of manning the office as people, you know, come and check their stuff and or bring new stuff in or take stuff out. Those people are, I mean, I would think would be an important element as well in this process.
Absolutely. You get a great syndicator, operator, asset manager, or whatever you want to call them, and they will hire a great property management team. That's right.
Gotcha. Now, you know, we're in strange economic times right now, and we're all watching, trying to figure out what the heck is going on here, whether or not a crash is on its way. We see inflation numbers. It's some say 6 already, some say, you know, 5 something. And we don't see a lot of change there. You sort of hinted in your, you know, when you just were speaking that, you know, during these times is when self-storage is in greatest demand. But, you know, I kind of look at it too as well. If you're, you know, if you're really tight on money and you're cutting expenses, isn't this one that you'd say, gee, I just got to close that storage unit down because that's sucking so much money, you know, each month. Can it work the opposite as well?
You would think. And I thought the same thing. That was one of the first questions I asked when I heard about self-storage in more detail. But the stories out in the field are saying in general, although there's obviously exceptions, in general, people don't want to lose their stuff. You know, they want to keep, whether it's stuff they inherited or whether it's stuff they bought. And even if they're downsizing from a 4,000 to a 2,000 square foot home or a 2,000 square foot home to an apartment, they really generally want to keep that extra huge walk-in closet called self-storage. And of course, like I said, there are exceptions, but the 4 D's is when self-storage does best. And they're all unfortunate, but they're real. And that's death, downsizing, divorce, and dislocation. Think about all the dislocation. People are moving en masse out of New York City, Chicago, California, to places like Tennessee, Texas, and Utah. And a lot of those people are using self-storage along the way. The middle part of my book, so the first third of the book is why self-storage, why we love it. The last third of the book is 7 paths to get in to self-storage or other commercial real estate opportunities. But the middle of the book has 4 different strategies to build a self-storage empire. Strategy 1 is to buy a coupon clipper, and that would be, again, buying one that's already operating pretty well and just, you know, expecting to get your 6% return in the mailbox. And there are people who do that. A lot of them run mediocre facilities, but they make money. It's not something most of us as real estate investors would want to do. The second strategy is build from the ground up. Now, that's the highest risk, but potentially highest return or highest loss strategy. And right now, I got off the phone with a guy about an hour ago, and he said, yeah, costs of building, literally the sheet metal, the concrete, the labor, they've literally doubled in a year. And so not a great time to be building facilities from the ground up, but there are people still doing it. The biggest risk in self-storage, by the way, if I didn't mention it, is a competitor popping up down the street. I mentioned the Tampa, Florida situation. That is the number one risk, that is somebody would pop up nearby in a lease-up time frame. And so, you know, building brand new and my next strategy are both the highest risk. The next strategy is retro. So retrofitting an old building. AJ Osborne is a friend of mine. He was on Bigger Pockets show 285, and he told the story about how he bought an old Super Kmart. He cut it in half, sold the parking lot off to apartment developers. He had $2.5 million in cash in it. He had $5 million in debt, $7.5 million total. It was 40% leased up as a beautiful state-of-the-art self-storage facility in two buildings. And he got an offer for $26 million that he turned down. So retrofitting an old Sears, Kmart, Toys R Us, or even an office building in some cases can be a great strategy. The fourth strategy, and my favorite, that balances risk and return is a value add strategy. A value add strategy would be, you know, going after these various value add opportunities. Some examples would be adding U-Haul. Now, you might not think that would be a great value add, but I have a friend in Florida, Rockledge, Florida. He's got a facility and he has $5,000 a month in U-Haul commission. Now, it's typical that they're $1,000 to $3,000. $5,000's a big high number, but let's say $3,000 a month. Let's do the value formula that we all know about from commercial real estate. The value equals the net operating income divided by the cap rate. Well, adding U-Haul adds a lot of net operating income and virtually no expenses. So let's say you could add $3,000 a month. That's $36,000 a year. Divide that by a 6% cap rate. And I actually don't have the math in front of me, but I believe that's a $600,000, if I remember right, increase in value. Imagine buying a $2 million facility and adding $600,000 in value. You might almost double your equity.
With U-Haul, do you have to become a franchisee?
No, you don't. All you have to do is lease trucks out of the front. You can be your own, like, you know, the Bill's Old Dogs, you know, self-storage, but still rent U-Haul out of the front.
Oh, interesting. So you can, you don't even have to purchase the trucks. You just have to lease them and the trailers and so forth.
Yeah, the U-Haul, the local U-Haul rep brings the trucks and has them placed there in front of your building.
Now, you have to pay that lease, though, regardless of whether it gets rented or not.
Not at all. Oh. No, the retail clients lease them. You just set up the paperwork and sweep them out and check them out when they're done.
Oh, interesting. So if you have something sitting on your lot that's not getting rented out, you're not losing money then.
Right. That's right. U-Haul takes that risk.
Wow. That's pretty good. What are some of the other add-ons here?
Yeah. So another value add is just adding U-Haul. It typically brings in more clients for retail items and ancillary items like locks, boxes, tape, scissors, and even rentals. Rentals go up, they say, 5% when you add a U-Haul. So another opportunity is at taking vacant land. A lot of these facilities have a lot of land out back. And you can gravel or pave them and add RVs and boats. And those are really popular right now since COVID. And so that's another reason these facilities have grown in popularity. You can also, you can raise rents. That doesn't sound like a value add, but if you can raise rents 15%, that can raise the value of your facility about 20% because your cost shouldn't go up, but your top line does. And that raised value of 20% with 66% debt, that's a 60% return on equity, just raising rents. Increasing occupancy, same thing. And these are the same for apartments, you get that. Adding some more climate-controlled spaces would be another thing. I mean, a lot of these older facilities have land available, some even out front. You can add a climate-controlled building out front. You can add ATMs, you can add billboards, you can add a propane filling station, even a cell tower in the back. Lots of ways to raise the revenue and therefore significantly increase the return on equity. We bought a facility actually through an operating partner in Beeville, Texas. It was on the market for over $5 million. We happened to call right when all five kids were fighting. The parents had apparently passed away some time ago. They were running it into the ground. And delinquency was high. Marketing was almost non-existent. They had 607 units, 80% full, but high delinquency. came in and acquired it for $2.4 million cash. So they just wanted to sell immediately. And, added a bunch of these value adds, increased the marketing, kicked out the bad tenants, increased the rental rates, got an appraisal. It was $2.4 million cash, got an appraisal for $4.6 million just 3 or 4 months later. Put debt on it at $2 million. That was 43% debt. Now, that would have been 80% plus debt up front if we'd have got $2 million on $2.4 million purchase. But it was only 43% LTV later, and that took the equity down to about $500,000 in equity left in there. And when we sold it, our operating partner sold it a year later for $4.6 million. Well, that was a huge profit, you know, on that $500,000 in equity, a couple million dollars in, value created.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a value add self-storage, and we love that, especially with all the mom and pops out there in the world.
Yeah, well, you mentioned you touched on something there, which I'm glad you kind of did, because I think one of the things that people have presented to me in the past is that, you get away from tenants, toilet and trash. Well, you that's not really true, because you could have, you may not have the toilets, but you could have the tenants and trash, you know. And, some of the horror stories that, I've heard, everybody from, making it a place for, to house stolen goods, to drugs, to, growing pot or whatever, or other illegal activity. I mean, there are tenants, and with that, comes issues. If somebody doesn't pay, you could have I don't know what they do with the items if they don't pay. I guess they just it's not like you can put it out on the curb.
No, you put a lock on it and basically say, look, we're leveraging your stuff to get you to pay.
Right.
And since it's a generally small amount of their total income, even if we're kicking them out, they're typically going to pay up the back lease and they're going to, take their stuff and leave, or it goes to an auction, which is not a great situation for anybody. But no, actually, one great thing is there's no eviction laws preventing eviction. There never has been, even during COVID.
Hmm. So what about those troublesome tenants? If a guy, you've got a lock on it, and let's say he shows up at the office with a, AK in his hand. I mean, it's a little scary.
I've never heard of that happening yet, but I see your point.
And drugs a common issue, or illegal, stolen items, things like that.
In a well-run facility with great security, great hands-on property management, I have heard that those are unusual events. They're not common occurrences.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's the people listening, I'm sure they're probably kind of wondering what is involved. Do they want to get their own facility? Would that make sense, or should they invest in an existing facility? What are some of those options to getting involved?
Yeah, the last third of the book tries to answer that question, and I'll try to go through it quickly. We've identified seven paths to get into self-storage. One would be to go the long and winding road, which would be taking a very small facility, improving it, learning your chops, getting it down, getting the systems and everything down, and then, leasing it up, raising the rates, cleaning it up, and then selling it and going to a bigger facility, then a bigger. And so we know that works. It takes a long time and it's hard, but it's definitely doable. The facility, I talked to the guy earlier in Kentucky, he wants $650,000 for 15,000 square feet. That's about 150 units. So that comes out to about $40 or $50 a square foot. And so someone could buy that, increase the rates, increase the marketing, beautify it, and maybe sell it for $70 a square foot, perhaps. And so by doing that, they could potentially double the investor's equity. So that would be, option one. Option two would be to be a deal finder. We all know that deal finders can these are people who go out and beat the streets, or they do direct marketing, or they, do something to try to find facilities and basically hand them over to syndicators and then get a piece of the action, staying involved so they can learn the business. A third option is a little similar, but that's raising money for other people's deals. To do this legally, of course, you have to be SEC compliant, which means you have to be a partner in the deal or you have to get a broker dealer's license typically. Option four would be if you have a lot of money, like let's say you inherited a lot of money, you have a lot of money, you won the lottery, you played Bitcoin and won, you could just jump in big. And to do that, I recommend getting a great team around you, hiring great asset management folks, getting a great third-party property manager, and then just jumping in at that level. It's not very practical for most of us. Option five, path five would be getting a job. You could get a job as a property manager, learn the lingo, learn the business, learn how to do it, and then go out and look to buy your own facility, or an asset manager. Or you could get a job as a broker or a lender in the self-storage business. And by doing that, you're becoming familiar with the people, the terminology, and the operations. And that is a way to get in, especially if you're younger. I know a guy in Dallas who quit his $120,000 a year job to take a $60,000 a year job managing a property so he could learn the business and buy his own. Option six would be to find a coach or mentor. And this is a very, very popular in the multifamily space, as we know. There's a few coaches and mentors in the self-storage space, and sometimes they'll partner with you. If you bring a deal or bring money, you can partner with them, and that's a great way to move down the road in this process. Option seven is be a professional or a semi-professional passive investor. And what I mean by that is you go out and find a fantastic operator. You really trust them. You go vet their deals, vet their company, carefully analyze their debt structure, do criminal background checks, et cetera. And then you invest heavily with them. And that is what most people do in this business. And that's what our company does for a living. We are professional passive investors, and we partner with investors who bring the cash, and we go out and find the best deals we can to invest in.
Great, great. So you are always looking for good projects out there, I would assume.
We're actually spending most of our time looking at the very best operators and trusting them to find the projects. We're trying to follow the Warren Buffett model, you know, of partnering with the very best management teams with a great product and then trusting them to grow the business.
Right, right. That's it sounds fascinating. It sounds like, you know, it's something that could really happen. What do you do though if you're that guy that's you know, you finally find your the place you want to be and you've got this great thing, and then one of these major franchises show up and just boom, you know, just kind of suck the life out of the business there. There's not much you can do, right?
It's really hard to fight those guys because think about it, Bill. They've got unlimited resources. They could lose money every month, year in and year out, for a couple years till they drive your numbers down so far. They either drive you out of business or they make an offer to buy you at a reduced price. And so you really want to take that. That's the number one issue you need to take into account. And so when we invested with a partner, I should say, in Beeville, Texas, we weren't worried about that. And when we invested in a 1,500 unit facility in Ishpeming, Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula, we weren't worried about a major competitor coming in. That's a recommended strategy in my mind.
Interesting. So, now, why would you say that was, you weren't concerned in that second example there?
Yeah, so in Beeville or Ishpeming, Michigan, we wouldn't expect Public Storage or Life Storage or one of these huge companies to come in. It's just, the numbers just aren't there. And they're focused generally on, you know, the suburbs of Dallas or suburbs of, you know, Irvine, California, to look for you know, self-storage facilities that are in more major areas.
So the population numbers aren't necessarily a key driver for you? I mean, it's got to be to a certain degree.
It's a key driver, but it's actually the number of square feet of self-storage in a 3 or 4 mile radius typically, or larger in Ishpeming, Michigan, much larger area, per It's the number of square feet of storage per person in that radius. So if you have 100,000 people in a 3 mile circle, 3 mile radius, I should say, you should be looking for 600,000 or 700,000 square feet or less, meaning you want to be at 6 or 7 square feet per person or less. If it's much, much higher than that, you could have problems.
Right. Wow, this is fascinating. We're kind of running crunch on our time here, but what other final things you think would be important for those listening to know if they're thinking about investing in self-storage?
One thing we love is, you know, what you mentioned earlier is inflation is running wild. Well, I mean, we don't like that, but you know what? If I have an Amazon warehouse or a big industrial project where I'm leasing, I have a 10 or even a 20-year lease to a large corporation, industrial, let's say, I can't catch that inflation. I've already locked in, you know, whether it's a 1 or 2 or 3% increase per year, that's locked in for a long, long time. Apartments are locked in, you know, typically for a year at a time. That's not as bad. Self-storage is the most flexible I know and the most able to capture inflation of any type of facility I know because it has 1 month leases. And so if I go in and raise the rates, you know, 3 times a year, 5% each, like I said, typically the tenants won't leave. And this is one of the things we really love about self-storage.
That's great. Well, I'm sure there's folks that are listening that want to find out more. We will definitely have a link to your new book that's coming out right before this airs. But I'm sure, you know, if they'd like to check out what you guys are doing in self-storage, what would be the best way for them to reach you?
Well, we have a special report on our website and on self-storage and another one on mobile home parks. And you can get that at Wellings Capital. That's W-E-L-L-I-N-G-S, wellingscapital.com. And then for those free resources, they can go to wellingscapital.com/resources.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Paul, it has been great having you back on again, man. I miss you. And hopefully we'll be able to grab some coffee out there somewhere between Virginia and Tennessee.
I really look forward to it, Bill. It's going to be great having you up here in the mountainous part of the country where taxes are low and people are kind and all that stuff.
I can't wait. Can't wait. Well, thank you so much for being on and sharing this right before your book comes out. That's exciting stuff.
Thanks, Bill. It's been a real honor to be on here. Great to be on here again.
Well, I appreciate you coming on. And I also want to thank all our old dog listeners out there for joining us. I know there's a lot of other things you could be doing right now, but the fact that you've taken the time to join us means a lot, and we really appreciate it. Please note everything that Paul talked about today, and there are going to be some links in there as well, can be accessed in our detailed show notes on the Old Dogs website at olddogsreinetwork.com/blog. And you're going to look for the episode with Paul Moore. Well, that's the show for today. Remember, cash flow is king and real estate investing the means. Until next time, keep moving forward and may God bless.
Thank you very much for visiting the Old Dogs REI Network. We would greatly appreciate if you would stop by iTunes and let us know what you think of the show. We would love if you could subscribe to the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and write a review. The more ratings and reviews we receive, the more visible the podcast will be to others. Thank you.